Kingfish, a 4-3 victory over La Crosse. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Partial clearing today, should see some sunshine at least. Cool and breezy, a high of 68, some 12 degrees cooler than normal for this time of year. Northeast winds at 10 to 15, gusting as high as 30 miles an hour. Clear skies tonight, a low around 50. Then for tomorrow, partly sunny, a slight chance of light rain in the afternoon, a better chance at night. Tomorrow's high around 70. A warming trend in the outlook. By the weekend, we should be back into the 80s. Right now, cloudy skies, a temperature reading in Kenosha of 59. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. We are going to be stepping into the middle of a very fiercely fought war, but not on a standard battlefield, but rather a war that was fought back in the 1990s between Nintendo and Sega. At the start of that decade, Nintendo had what really amounted to a monopoly in the booming video game industry, and Sega was just one of a number of pretenders wanting to make some kind of a dent in the awesome industrial strength of Nintendo and all that it had created. And for a time, it actually managed to do that before falling from its self-erected pedestal. And, of course, the whole industry of video games changed dramatically after that. And many of the rules that seemed to be in play at that time have really given way to a brand new landscape. But we step back in time, and we do so in a very vividly written book, which is called The Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. And the book by Blake J. Harris has attracted a great deal of attention. In fact, it has spurred the creation of a documentary and also a feature film adaption of this book, which I know a lot of people are eagerly awaiting. In the meantime, our purpose today is to talk about the book, which is available in paperback by Day Street, which is an imprint of William Morrow. Again, the book is called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. And Blake J. Harris, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm really excited to talk with you. I do need to say that I am not much of a video game person, so much of this is talking about stuff which is way beyond me, way above my head, and yet I still found the book really, really fascinating and fun. So that's one of the things I would say right off the bat, is that one does not have to be deeply immersed in video gaming. One does not have to have been sort of on one side or the other of this battle between Nintendo and Sega to really find the story quite compelling. As you said about writing it, did you think about that very much, about who you thought would find this book interesting and who you wanted to sort of craft it for?
I did. So that is very nice for me to hear. My ideal reader throughout the process was my grandmother, who's somebody who doesn't know anything about video games except that I used to beg her to buy them for me when I was a kid. But I just found, you know, what this story really is about is these larger-than-life characters and these universal themes of an underdog story and, you know, pulling together and the Wild West of any industry. And so I'm so glad that it, you know, it resonated with you, because I did write it for gamers and non-gamers alike, because I think that this is an important story, and these are heroes, these are pioneers, and I wanted to make sure that it was accessible to anybody, regardless of how much you used to play games or how much you play them today.
You are telling us about events primarily that occurred in the early 1990s. So how old were you in the early 1990s? And in a sense, how much was this battle between Nintendo and Sega? How much were you aware of this battle at the time? I mean, were you old enough that you were playing video games and sort of a participant in this fray?
It's a good question. I'm 32 years old, so, you know, back then I was 10, 12, 8, around that range. And what's very interesting for me, you know, writing this book and researching it was sort of like a behind-the-scenes look at my childhood. So it was all based on events that I vaguely remembered, and I was absolutely a participant in this battle, because back then, I don't even think the word gamer existed. If you were a kid, you played video games, because that's how you went about making friends. It was really the social lubricant of our times. I would not call up my friends to say, hey, you want to talk about girls or sports? I'd say, want to play video games? And then we talk about girls and sports. So I think it was a huge part of the culture for anybody between ages like 6 and 15 at the time. So I was a soldier on the front lines, but I had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. I knew that Nintendo was popular. I did not realize that, as you mentioned, they pretty much had a monopoly and used business tactics to enforce that. And I didn't realize that how Sega was able to come out of nowhere. You know, I think that as a kid, and even a lot of times as an adult, we sort of imagine that there is this meritocracy to products, where the good products, you know, end up on the shelves and the ones, better ones, get purchased the most. But that's not really how it works. There's retailers involved. There's developers involved for the gaming industry. It's a whole process. And there's a lot of business decisions that go into it. And sort of what attracted me to that side of the story was my own personal experience, where I had an 8-bit Nintendo Entertainment System, like 1 in 3 households in America. I desperately wanted the Super Nintendo when it was coming out, because I figured, you know, I love Nintendo. Why would I leave the ship now? But my parents would not buy it for me and my brother, because it did not have backward compatibility, which ultimately was a business decision. Nintendo decided that it wasn't worth the extra money. And a lot of parents were upset about that after investing hundreds or thousands of dollars in Nintendo products. And so I always found that kind of fascinating, that because of a decision made in the back room one day, I ended up switching from Team Nintendo to Team Sega, and it altered my childhood.
Wow. And just because this is really important, but for someone who didn't participate in this, I want to make sure we make this really clear. What was the decision that Nintendo made in terms of Super Nintendo that, in a sense, led to this fracture, at least in your own household, that matter of compatibility? Explain that to those of us who are novices in all this.
Sure. So the Super Nintendo came out in late 1991, and it's a 16-bit system, which is more powerful than Nintendo's previous 8-bit system. And, you know, the 16-bit system, the new Super Nintendo, did not have backward compatibility, meaning that you can't play your old games on the new system. This is also, I feel like it's important to mention, back in an era where anything that went on behind the television was like a huge mystery. You know, nowadays we switch inputs and we're kind of a little bit more familiar with HDMI cord. But, you know, as easy as it probably would have been to switch, you know, your Nintendo to the Super Nintendo on the TV and back and forth, people really saw this as Nintendo abandoning their customer base. And it was also combined with, you know, Nintendo's bedside manner. They had a lot of leverage, and they were perceived as arrogant about it, which I think that a lot of parents and consumers did not like. And Sega really took advantage of that. Nintendo made a lot of enemies on their way up the ladder over there. And, you know, one of Sega's early strategies was essentially to form a cartel of Nintendo's enemies and go after them.
Hmm. And, of course, we're talking about a point in time when the Internet is not yet a part of people's daily lives, or very few people's daily lives. And so, I mean, now we're in an environment where companies all the time convey lots of information about their products, about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And if they don't offer it up freely, there are means to sort of go after that information. But of course, the early 1990s is still back in the Stone Age, as it were, although we're talking about something like video games. But in terms of the availability of the kind of information that we're talking about, and I suppose it led to a sense of impregnability of certain companies who felt like they could do kind of whatever they chose to do. And of course, that day was about to draw to a close as well.
Yeah, I mean, for those of us who lived it, myself and yourself, you know, we didn't realize it was the Stone Age. But to give you a good example of what it was like, I remember one time going to the mall with my parents and my brother, and as a special reward, they were going to buy us a Nintendo game. This was the first time they were going to buy us a game that wasn't for a birthday or a holiday. And our entire criteria for selecting what game we wanted was the back of the box. You know, there were no commercials, there were no trailers. There was very few ways to know what you were getting other than word of mouth or the back of the box. And one of those other ways was magazines like Nintendo Power, which Nintendo owned and notoriously didn't share with other companies. And so, you know, that was sort of, to your point, an example of how one of the few information outlets was controlled by Nintendo, and they, you know, did not see much desire to really relent or to shine a light on others.
We're talking with Blake J. Harris, and we're talking about his book called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. In many respects, your book is primarily about Sega, which is the challenger of Nintendo, and for a brief time, a very successful challenger, and quite unexpectedly, given Nintendo's incredible place of power in the world of video games. Before we talk about Sega, I want to talk about Nintendo and how it sort of achieved that pinnacle of prominence. But even ahead of talking about Nintendo, although your book doesn't get into this very much, I suspect that you have some acquaintance with sort of the more distant past in terms of video games. For those of us old enough to remember something, for instance, like Pong, when it first came out, I mean, that felt like the space age when those of us who played Pong in, I think it was the early 1970s, first had that sleepy little tennis ball blipping across the screen. Little did we know where this was going to lead. Is that where all of this started, with these really small little games like Pong? And at what point did video games really sort of step up into another level ahead of the emergence of Nintendo?
So kind of what happened, well, it's worth noting that the guys who were at these companies kind of grew up on Pong and Pitfall and those earlier games. So it was like magic to them hearing them describe it even all these years later. And that's part of what inspired them to get in the industry. But in terms of how we went from Pong to where Nintendo took us, and also just the business prowess of that, you know, what happened was, and it was kind of interesting for me, was, as you mentioned, and we'll get into it a little bit, you know, the focal point of the story, especially the first half, is Sega, because they're the underdog. They're the David and Goliath tale. But when I kind of start to learn more about Nintendo and speak with their employees, I learned that they, too, were David in their own David and Goliath story about 5 or 10 years earlier, which is because the video game industry crashed in 1983. Atari, Mattel, and Television, ColecoVision, there was an oversaturation of games. There was an influx of terrible games, highlighted by E.T., which was buried in the New Mexico landfill that was recently dug up. So the industry collapsed, and people thought video games were over, which in hindsight I realize sounds a little bit silly. But if you think about the rise of the personal computer, it's not that silly, because games could have just been computer games, and people didn't need to buy a dedicated console to play their video game. But Nintendo decided to step into the ring. They, too, were a small arcade company at the time, and they really put everything on the line to try to resurrect the industry. And they were the ones that really took video games to the next level, just in terms of quality, with games like Super Mario Brothers, The Legend of Zelda, Contra, a personal favorite of mine. And they, you know, the way that they initially got their foot in the door of what became a monopoly was quality games, which is a good thing. And I remember fondly playing those games.
Hmm. One of the things I especially appreciate about your book is that I think a lot of people who buy your book are going to be really amazed when they see that the creation of the company, still known as Nintendo, dates back to September 23rd, 1889. I mean, the telephone has barely been invented. The phonograph has barely been invented. And here there is a company called Nintendo, which has just opened by a Japanese entrepreneur with the last name of Yamauchi. And I'm so glad that in this book, which of course is about very much modern times and modern developments, we actually are talking about, in the case of Nintendo, a company whose history stretches back that far. Just sketch for our listeners a little bit about the interesting origins of Nintendo, decades before there was any such notion of something like a video game.
Yeah, so, you know, the action in the book takes place generally between 1985 and 1995, but to really understand why these companies did what they did and what their corporate identity was like, you know, we have to kind of go back, and it was so fun with Nintendo because I didn't even know going in that they had been around for over 100 years, and they had been in the playing card business. They made Hanafuda cards. And originally there were these hand-painted, beautiful cards, and they kind of gained a lot of traction by getting these into the casino parlors, and that was really where Nintendo first made their name. And through that, they were able to set up this really impressive distribution outlet for playing cards. And then along the way, as businesses evolved and technology improved, they thought, what could we use this distribution network to do other than playing cards that could, you know, be used to our advantage? And one of the ideas they came up with after some very strange toys was the Famicom, which, when imported to the United States, was the Nintendo Entertainment System. And it's just so fascinating to think about how it all started from playing cards. And it also gives you a sense of what Nintendo was like. You know, they were a smaller company, and they had no experience in video games, especially, you know, when you think about Atari trying to come back and those other games that sort of put video games on the map. You know, Nintendo was kind of this small guy coming into the ring, but they did have a long storied history as a playing card company, and they also had a very conservative nature because they'd been around for decades and decades, and, you know, maybe they could afford to play a longer game than other competitors could, who needed to get in and make a wave very quickly.
Hmm. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about the story of Donkey Kong and the legal trouble which this game stirred up, essentially because of its name, and the legal battle which ensued. I think it's worth talking about because you, in the book, make the point that the way this legal squabble played out, the way Nintendo fought for itself, sort of indicated something about the cultural climate there, and yep. and tells us a little bit about how they were going to be competing with the rest of the world from that point on.
Yeah, so in the early 1980s, before Nintendo got into the home console business, when they were just in the arcade business, they had a game called Donkey Kong, which was their first big, massive hit. It was created by a developer named Shigeru Miyamoto, who is the most famous and most beloved developer of all time. He went on to create Mario and Zelda and most of Nintendo's flagship titles. And following the success of this game, there was a legal battle from Universal Studios, who claimed that Nintendo was infringing upon their King Kong movie franchise. Because of the name Kong, of course. And because Nintendo was in the arcade business, you know, and there were people in the console business like Atari and Coleco, Nintendo had licensed out the game to these companies so that they could be released on the home version. And all of those companies were sued by Universal as well as Nintendo. And all of those companies, in some form or another, settled with Universal because Universal had deep pockets and fancy lawyers, and they were asking for a lot of money. So rather than take the risk of losing hundreds of millions of dollars, they decided to just pay $10 million or so. And but Nintendo took a different stance. They felt that they had not infringed. They were led by a man named Howard Lincoln, who would guide the company for the next few decades and also is now the current CEO of Seattle Mariners, which Nintendo owns. And he was kind of defiant and said he had a legal background and said, we can win this thing. And so Nintendo decided to stand up to Universal. They ended up winning the case, and it really set the tone within Nintendo and also to the rest of the industry that Nintendo was going to be very aggressive legally, and they weren't going to take any nonsense from anyone.
Right. They had an appetite for litigiousness, I guess we could say, and that would, in a sense, really serve them well for what was ahead. As you spell out the rise of Nintendo, you do it in eight sections, and along the way you underscore the important contributions of a number of different, central characters or central figures. Mm-hmm. One of them that intrigues me the most is a guy by the name of Peter Main. And
yep.
I think one of the reasons his contribution sort of jumped out at me is the fact that he came to Nintendo very much as an outsider. I mean, not part of the whole video gaming craze at all. And you underline the fact that this probably helped him. He made a really invaluable contribution to Nintendo's fortunes exactly because he was an outsider. What was his contribution to Nintendo's great success story, and to what extent do you think his being an outsider of the industry made a difference in that?
Well, Peter Main is a great character. Prior to joining Nintendo, he was in the hamburger sales business, and he was running a bunch of white spot restaurant chains up in Canada. And he had a neighbor from a few years earlier named Minoru Arakawa, who in the early 80s left Vancouver to go run and open a place called Nintendo of America. Peter had no idea what that was. You know, video games were supposed to be dead. But then he got a call from Arakawa saying, you know, this thing is starting to blow up, and we need someone to come in and legitimize it because, you know, sort of in that same spirit of Nintendo taking advantage of the distribution network with toy stores, you know, there wasn't much respect for video games. It was considered a toy business, and it also, Nintendo was this strange Japanese company that nobody knew. You know, whether or not you liked Atari or Mattel in the previous generation, at least they were known quantities. So Peter's job was to come in and convince Wall Street, convince retailers that Nintendo was for real. And also, you know, as you mentioned, he had an outsider's mentality. It was extremely helpful during that time to really help grow this into more than a fad. You know, Nintendo didn't want to be the next hula hoop. They wanted to be the name of video games. And Peter has a famous motto, which is the name of the game of the game, meaning that, you know, as much as it's his job to make it successful, at the end of the day, it's the game that is what matters. And one thing I will say about Nintendo, though I had a up and down relationship with them while writing the book, and also, you know, it's been years since they've been on top of the video game industry, I have never bought a product from them in my 32 years alive that wasn't a fantastic game. They make sure that everything that they put out is up to the Nintendo quality, and at times that causes conflict because if other game developers want to make a game for them, they make sure that it's up to Nintendo quality, which ends up costing the developer more money and more time. But the name of the game was a game, and that's something that Peter really instilled because, you know, whether it was selling burgers or whether it was selling products that any other place he'd been in his career, that, you know, you can't lose sight of the fact that you are selling an item that people do not need. This is a luxury item, and you need to make sure that it is something that is worth their buying. And then, in addition to that, one of the things that Nintendo did to try to avoid an industry collapse was they put into place things like game counselors that can call up and speak with people at Nintendo about how to beat difficult levels. They also put out Nintendo Power, which was a guidebook to help, you know, beat difficult levels. And they wanted to do everything possible to build an infrastructure around this industry so that it didn't fall apart again and so that it felt substantial and legitimate.
Hmm. Towards that end, they also instigated a couple of reforms, which you tell us caused some controversy. One of them involved third-party licensing programs, and the other was the matter of very strict management of inventory. And again, this was from the sounds of it, a very different practice from what had happened in previous years when the industry sort of exploded out of control and sort of fell into mediocrity. What were these somewhat controversial measures about, and what difference did they make in Nintendo achieving this air of supremacy in the industry?
Well, you know, one of the other things that Peter Main did was he wanted to make sure that Nintendo undersupplied the retailers. He wanted people to be clamoring for Nintendo products and having to travel from store to store to try to find it with hit titles, as opposed to flooding the market as Atari had done. And this is controversial. My favorite headline I ever found was from the New York Times in 1989, where it said, "Peter Main, master marketer or monopolist?" Because that was kind of Nintendo's approach, and they would end up getting into some legal trouble with some antitrust litigation following some of these practices. But Nintendo really wanted to control every facet of the operation. And, you know, as you mentioned with the third-party licensees, that's, you know, a licensee is someone who's making a game for the Nintendo system. So it's not a game that Nintendo is developing in-house, but it's a company's making it that's going to be come out on Nintendo system. And Nintendo would limit the number of games that a developer can come up with to 5. And, you know, they felt like, well, if we make 8 good games, why should we only have 5? And they were making millions and millions of dollars off of these games. So they felt at times like Nintendo was limiting how much they can make. And one of the other things that was part of that third-party agreement was that you had to buy the cartridges from Nintendo. So when there was a chip shortage or an alleged chip shortage in 1987 and 88, and developers couldn't get their games out. So it felt like, once again, Nintendo was dictating everything. You know, they felt like, well, all right, we'll get a chip somewhere else. If we only have 5 games. But Nintendo was masterful in their control, and it worked really well. You know, there was a lot of allegations of illegal practices and also just a dictatorial sensibility, which is probably true. But the one thing I will say in their defense is that, you know, when you are undersupplying, if somebody wants to order 10 million cartridges and you only give them 2 million, you're leaving money on the table. You know, that's 8 million cartridges that you could instantly make money on. So there is something somewhat noble about the desire to do this. Maybe I don't always agree with it, but it is interesting that they were so, they believed so much in their philosophy that they were willing to pass up short-term money for what they believed was a long-term game plan.
Right, and of course, it did work out spectacularly well. So give us an idea of just how supreme Nintendo was in the year 1990. That's just before Sega emerges as actually a surprisingly fierce competitor. But just ahead of that, I mean, to what extent was Nintendo absolutely, unassailably number one in the business of video games?
I mean, they were literally taking out ads that there is no such thing as a Nintendo, because people were using the word Nintendo to describe video games. And Nintendo didn't want to lose the trademark in the way that Jacuzzi has with hot tubs or Kleenex has with tissues, where it's so popular that it comes to define the brand. You know, my mom still calls everything a Nintendo, but Nintendo didn't want that to happen. But it made sense that it would, because they controlled 95% of the industry. They were video games, and there were some pretenders to the throne in the form of Sega, and NEC had a console that came out called the TurboGrafx. But they really didn't think twice about these competitors, because they just didn't have the install base that Nintendo had, and they didn't have the ability to make the quality games that Nintendo did, or so they thought. But, you know, and speaking just purely in terms of numbers, in 1989, Nintendo accounted for 25 of the top 30 toy products sold by toy stores. And with a retailer as big as Walmart, Nintendo accounted for nearly 10% of their profits, just this tiny Nintendo section of the store. So they really had a lot of leverage and an unprecedented amount for, this technology space.
We're speaking with Blake J. Harris about his book, Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. So now's the time to actually finally start talking, in a sense, about what your book is mostly about, this spirited challenge from this upstart company called Sega. And, of course, in particular, the specific talented man by the name of Tom Kalinske, who really led the charge and did incredible things. Before we talk about Tom Kalinske, let's talk about Sega at this point in time. At how long had Sega been around? What kind of company was it? And were they a significant player at all before Tom Kalinske came along?
So Sega was founded in the mid-60s in Japan, though, interestingly enough, by an American. So it was a Japanese company with an American founder. And they had been around for 25 years or almost 25 years to this point, and they had been mostly an arcade company. They started off making, with those little photo booths that were similar to what we used to go to see in the movies, where you put in the dollar and get your photo taken with your girlfriend. But they really excelled in the arcade arena. And one thing they found when they tried to translate into the home console business was that it's a very different, beast. An arcade game is predicated on getting you to continuously put in quarters. So you're supposed to get a little bit further each time, but, it doesn't need to be hours and hours of fun. Whereas a home console, that's the whole point of it, is that you can play this thing, you can stay up all night. And Sega just didn't really have the games to compete, and they didn't have the hardware to compete. They had tried. They had released an 8-bit Master System to compete against Nintendo's 8-bit NES system. They failed miserably. And so their thought was, if we can't win this battle, let's change the location of the battle to a higher technological platform to 16 bits. It's twice as good. And that didn't really work right away. The Sega Genesis, their 16-bit system, came out in 1989. It beat the TurboGrafx, which ensured Sega the number two spot, but at the time the number two spot had about 2% of the market. So that was not too impressive there, but everything really started to change with the arrival of two new characters, one being Tom Kalinske and the other being Sonic the Hedgehog.
Let's talk about this really important central figure in your book, Tom Kalinske. And ahead of what he managed to accomplish at Sega, he had already tasted some stupendous success in his life with a couple of different breakthroughs at a couple of different companies that really made it seem like Tom Kalinske was King Midas with that veritable touch of gold.
He was, and he still is. The first time I spoke to Tom, sort of as some small talk, I asked, what were you doing before you joined Sega in 1990? And I learned very quickly that other than my parents, this was the man most responsible for my childhood, whether it was helping to develop the Flintstones kids' chewable vitamins or resurrecting the Barbie doll, or developing the He-Man Masters of the Universe line. This guy just had the golden touch, as you said, and he continues to have it. But he brought that to Sega in 1990, not knowing anything about video games, but loving a good uphill battle and putting together this ragtag squad that was able to pull it off.
So tell us about the sort of the trajectory of his career, which ultimately led him to Sega, to the overtures that came from Sega for him to come aboard, and why they would have sought him out.
Sure. So he was sort of known as the prince of the toy industry for all of those, for some, those things and many more that I had mentioned earlier. And but he wanted to be the king at Mattel, and he was placed as the co-king. When Mattel was going through transition, they appointed three co-CEOs, Tom being one of them, and that did not really work out politically for much for the company, and Tom ended up leaving. He resigned, but it was not a situation that he was happy with how it ended. And he was kind of, a couple of years later, between jobs, not really sure what was next for him, whether he'd ever have that chance to use his golden touch again, or maybe it had all just been luck and kind of maybe doubting himself. But he was on a beach in Hawaii with his wife, trying to figure out what to do next. And out of nowhere comes Hayao Nakayama, the head of Sega of Japan, who says to Tom, you know, I've been looking for you. I tracked you down. I want you to run Sega and take down Nintendo. And Tom says some version of, you know, you're blocking the sun, get out of the way, and what the heck is Sega? But from there he went, and, you know, very quickly, within 3 years, Sega was able to turn things around.
I wonder if you could say a word about the matter of Tom Kalinske being an American and Sega, at least in so many respects, was a thoroughly Japanese company. To what extent was that an issue? To what extent was it a problem? And to what extent was it, in a sense, a source of strength for a company like Sega to join forces with someone like Tom Kalinske?
I mean, it ended up becoming a huge deal. I went into this book thinking that the most important battle I'd be writing about was that between Sega and Nintendo, but it turned out to really be between Sega of America and Sega of Japan, and this cultural conflict that ended up ultimately doing the company. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that under Tom's leadership, Sega of America was enormously successful. They were able to surpass and overtake Nintendo and become the market leader, and seems poised to be there for many years. But in Japan, Sega was never really that successful. You know, if they had up to 60% of the market here, they never really had more than 20% over there. And that created a strange dynamic where the subsidiary was much more successful than the parent company. And the parent company just wasn't willing to do the things that Tom's team was willing to do, which was, you know, competitive advertising with great commercials, to really put all their eggs into the basket of Sonic the Hedgehog, to start making sports games, and a bunch of other things. And in Japan, they were not successful. There was jealousy, and there was also a desire to move on from what was successful in America, you know, and go on to the next generation of system, where, as Tom's team felt like, we are finally hitting our stride. We need to keep going with this. But by the end of it, they were kind of undercutting their counterparts in America, and that is a large part of what led to the downfall.
I really appreciate your attention to detail and certain fascinating little details that someone else might have skipped right over. For instance, you describe the first time that Tom Kalinske stepped into a meeting at Sega, and what the atmosphere was like in that room, and the way in which these, I would assume all men or mostly men, were communicating with one another, albeit shouting at one another. I mean, just a chaotic cacophony, like nothing I think he'd ever really experienced before in a boardroom. Tell us about that, and why a moment like that is really important in understanding Tom Kalinske's situation as he came aboard at Sega.
Yes, so Tom joined in the fall of 1990, and after a few months of, you know, kind of putting the team together, figuring out what to do, he went to Japan to the parent company to present his vision for how Sega could, I mean, at the time, I don't even think take down Nintendo was their goal. It was really just to carve out a viable spot for the second company in the video game industry and ensure Sega's survival. And he went out there and had presented a four-point plan, which included things like dropping the price of the Sega Genesis, giving away their new upcoming hit game, Sonic the Hedgehog, for free, you know, including it with the Sega Genesis so that everybody who bought a Genesis would have it, going after Nintendo head-to-head in advertising, and other aggressive tactics like that. And man, the response was not good. He was there with his right-hand man, Shinobu Toyota, who was translating select portions of what was being said, whatever was suitable for Tom to hear. But they were not big fans of Tom. They thought he was trying to destroy the company. You know, these things just aren't done, going head-to-head after a competitor. That doesn't happen. You know, you don't do that in Japanese business. But luckily, the guy, Hayao Nakayama, who had found Tom on the beach, quieted everyone in the room and said, you know, nobody really agrees with what you're saying, Tom, and I'm not even sure that I do, essentially. But I hired you to shake things up and to do things your way. So you have a mandate to do as you please. And that's exactly what they did. And it paid off handsomely in the next 2 years.
What would you say were the maybe one or two of the most important decisions which Tom Kalinske made, which made the most sort of immediate and dramatic difference? And in particular, what moves did he make that, in a sense, were courageous, maybe even outrageous moves that really sort of reshaped Sega's whole approach?
Well, I'll mention two things. You know, one sort of more abstract and just conceptually changed the way that video games are perceived today is Tom identified that Nintendo was dominant. There was no doubt about that. But they were dominant amongst kids 6 to 14 years old. And, you know, with one-tenth of the budget of Nintendo and with less clout, Tom basically conceded and said, you know, we can't break that. That Nintendo makes good games for that market. We're not going to be able to beat that. So let's go after older kids and adults. Let's try to transform video games from childish playthings into a mainstream form of entertainment. So even if we're not taking away Nintendo's customers, we're adding new customers. And that is really the main legacy of Sega and Tom's leadership, because nowadays, you know, the average age of a gamer is about my age, early 30s. And of course, part of that is because we've all grown up. But video games have become a mainstream source of entertainment. The industry is now bigger than Hollywood and music industry combined. And that was all under Tom's regime at Sega, just transforming the way that we think about video games. Like, for example, you know, all video game cartoons previously had come on during Saturday morning cartoons or Saturday or, you know, weekday afternoon cartoons. But when Sega debuted their famous Welcome to the Next Level campaign, which ended with the Sega scream, the Sega, at the end of each one, that debuted during the MTV Awards. And, you know, and Sega did a lot of stuff with MTV, with Nickelodeon, with some of these funkier, edgier brands. And they really sort of managed to capture the zeitgeist at the time and really the cultural attitude. And that was also very evident in Sonic the Hedgehog. You know, I think that he really personified that early 90s mentality. And he was kind of modeled after Michael Jackson and Bill Clinton and meant to really capture that cultural feeling. Sega utilized when changing the industry. And to give you a more concrete example, just to kind of describe Tom's mentality and how Sega operated during that time was, you know, I mentioned earlier that Nintendo accounted for 10% of Walmart's profits. So when Tom and Shinobu Toyota went down to Bentonville, Arkansas, the headquarters of Walmart, they pitched why Walmart should carry the Sega Genesis. They explained why it was better than what Nintendo was doing. And the guy basically said, yeah, okay, I mean, it seems pretty good. Maybe it seems better, but there's no way we're going to carry this because we don't want to anger Nintendo. Nintendo had a reputation for, you know, punishing retailers who carried competitors' products by maybe the next time this truck was on the way, it would mysteriously disappear and you wouldn't get what you wanted. Walmart saw no need to mess with the beast and anger Nintendo, and that really pissed off Tom. He thought they had a better product, and he also thought that he had a good relationship with Walmart from his previous industry experience at Mattel. So he was kind of surprised, but, you know, he took that as a challenge, and as he and Shinobu were leaving the flagship Walmart, or as they were leaving the Walmart headquarters, they saw across the street a For Rent sign at a mall. They decided to purchase the space, open a Sega Genesis store that did not sell any Genesis games, but just invited people to come in and play Sega all day long for free. They bought every billboard in the town. They bought seat cushions at the football games, and they turned Bentonville, Arkansas into Segaville to the point where people every day were going into the flagship Walmart store and saying, hey, where do I get a Sega Genesis? And eventually the executive called up Tom and said, you know, we wave the red flag, we give up, we'll carry your product, just take down those billboards.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
It is, and that's where, you know, that's why I feel like this book is appealing to gamers and non-gamers alike, because that story is so much of what these guys were all about, just not taking no for an answer, always looking for outside-the-box ideas. And, yes, you know, that helped mature the video game industry and change what it was, but it's just something that, you know, I've learned, like, it's a life lesson that I take to everything I do, you know, always just looking for that extra angle and never giving up.
Right. And, of course, it parallels certain other breakthroughs in our own history when there is this vast new universe, which people didn't even realize was there because it wasn't there until some breakthrough sort of makes it possible. And, I mean, something like the telephone or something like the phonograph or something like the automobile. And in this case, although video games had been around, this notion that video games are not just a toy, but video games are something that that can be a whole new genre of entertainment, and one which will connect not only with little kids, but with teenagers and young adults and old adults. And, I mean, there's just a world of profit waiting to be made, and one can understand why people would go about things so fiercely. We have go ahead.
I was just saying, and that's why Tom always sort of felt to me like the Steve Jobs of the industry, where, you know, Steve did not create the first Apple computer, Steve Wozniak did, and Steve didn't invent the iPod, but he played a critical role in getting it out there and changing the way that we perceive these products. And it was more than just being a showman. It was the guy who convinced you that this is a real thing, a big deal. It's not just some flash in the pan, and you know, brought it and made it and created this mass appeal.
Right. And I was glad earlier in the interview when you said something to the effect that this is not just the newest hula hoop. I mean, like
right.
one more game, and right after that'll be the Etch-a-Sketch, and one after that'll be the Slinky, and after that'll be another toy, and each one will have its brief moment of glory and then recede in the background as other things come to the fore. But this this was something else. This had the potential to be a spectacular new kind of entertainment. And a whole universe, which would, which of course, change everything. In just the last minute or so, we do need to say a word about how Sega does not remain at the pinnacle, and it seems to have to do not with any mistake that Tom Kalinske made, but with Sega being unwilling to go where Tom Kalinske wanted to lead them.
Yeah, I mean, after 5 years, Tom has Sega pretty much where they wanted to be, but that collision and that conflict with Sega of Japan ultimately led to them vetoing his decision. It was kind of like that situation we talked about earlier in the boardroom, except now it was the opposite outcome, where they said, everyone disagrees with you, and we're not going to do what you say, even though you've proven time and again to be right. And so Tom left the company in 1996. Sega released a couple more consoles, the Sega Saturn and the Dreamcast, and they ultimately left the hardware business. They continued to make software, which they do to this day. But earlier this year, they closed down their Sega of America office so that it doesn't even exist anymore, which I guess puts a final ribbon on their demise, at least in terms of the America versus Japan conflict. And it was sad for me. I guess the part that was uplifting was that Tom is still doing great stuff, as are the key members of the team, like Al Milson, Shinobu Toyota, Diane Fournassier. So, you know, it was this brief shining moment of time where they changed the industry and really pioneered what video games were. And I'm happy to see that the individuals themselves have benefited tremendously and are still going strong. But it is a real shame to see that Sega has fallen so far from grace.
Well, the story of all that and more is told in this book called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. The book is published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow, and the author, Blake J. Harris. And we want to remind everyone that Console Wars is being transformed both into a documentary film and ultimately into a feature-length film. And I know a lot of people await both of those films very eagerly. Blake Harris, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the family of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager manager and occasional morning show co-host. Skies will become partly sunny today. It will be cooler and breezy today with a high of 68 degrees with strong winds from the northeast. This is WGTD HD.